From the Stormy Sea to the Clouds of Heaven. Commentary for the February 22, 2020 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream, Daniel 7, verse 1. For the first six chapters, Daniel has been written more or less in chronological sequence. Now we see an abrupt change. Chapter 6 was about events under the reign of Darius I, after the conquest of Babylon. But chapter 7 is apparently dated to a time before the Persian threat, in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. That in itself is problematic, for is that dated concurrently with Nabonidus's first year of 556 BC, or does it date from the period he was reigning at the request of Nabonidus, perhaps allowing Nabonidus to stay in Timna, where he resided for a decade? If so, that would be about 553 BC. 3 years is not a significant difference when viewed from 2.5 millennia later, but it illustrates the fuzziness surrounding who was reigning after Nabonidus's accession to the throne, and who was where at any given time during that reign, especially in light of the battles with Cyrus and the manner of Babylon's conquest. In any event, Daniel seems to have taken a prophetic detour into the past with chapters 7 and 8 before returning to the present with chapter 9. Some may feel that these chapters represent a later accretion to the text, similar to what has been felt about chapters 13 and 14, which are not included in most Bibles today. Whether that is the case or not, one might rightly wonder why these chapters are not in their rightful place before chapter 5. One might think that the political climate might have been more favorable for those chapters after Babylon fell, but the book of Daniel obviously could not have been completed before that event anyway, as a record contained in chapters 6 and 9 through 12 lead us to conclude. Some might feel the chronological hiccup might be attributed to the middle portion of Daniel being written in Aramaic as opposed to the Hebrew of the remainder. However, the temporal reversion occurs within the Aramaic portion, which ends at the end of chapter 7, rather than where one might expect at the end of chapter 6. One plausible theory is that Daniel jumps around like this because the author was more focused on preserving a chiastic parallel than a timeline of events. The chiasm, then, would be bookended with the parallel visions of Daniel, chapter 2, four kingdoms to be followed by the kingdom of God, and Daniel chapter 7, four kingdoms to be followed by the kingdom of God. If the original had chapter 7 before chapter 5, then in order to create such a chiasm, simply moving that portion of the text would perfect the narrative in the eyes of the editor. While plausible, this also argues strongly for the book, as we know it today, being a later compilation of earlier sources. Current biblical scholarship places the creation of the compilation at some time in the early 2nd century BC, a few centuries after the events in the book were to have taken place. Regardless of who wrote what originally and how accurately it was preserved, the book appears to be very much the work of a later editor or group of editors who were perhaps seeking a foundational justification for a resurrected Jewish state based on God having ordained not only the four kingdoms in chapters 2 and 7, but also the restored kingdom of God. That phrase, kingdom of God, likely resonated with self-identification for the Jewish people. Perhaps that Jewish receptiveness to the phrase is the same reason the New Testament, and especially the Gospels, repeatedly mention it. What is problematic and adds to our confusion when dealing with the prophecies of Daniel is that conflicted understanding of what and when the kingdom of God is. The Jews have commonly believed that it represents the coming of the Messiah and the restoration of a Jewish theocratic state. They believe that event is future and there is no first and second coming, only one. Consequently, anything that advances the interests of the Jewish state can be seen as a precursor to the Messiah's revelation. This, for them, is a stone in Daniel chapter 2, and the chiasm within Daniel 7 defines this as the restored power of the holy people. The establishment of the kingdom of God is closely linked with the destruction of the fourth kingdom of Daniel's two visions. Interestingly, although apparently prophetic in nature, the book of Daniel is not grouped with the prophetic books in the Tanakh, or Hebrew Bible, but instead is in the historical writings with Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. Is this an indication of its significance as historical narrative, as opposed to its prophetic importance? Christians faced with the apparent reference to the kingdom of God's establishment at the end of the two parallel prophecies of chapters 2 and 7 have developed a similar but also altered understanding of the stone of Daniel, chapter 2. Ignoring the fact that there is only one iteration of the kingdom of God in each chapter that overlooks the importance of the incarnation, the stone in chapter 2 and its corresponding alternative in chapter 7 are projected into the future to the parousia. While this singular focus is understandable for the Jewish Messiah has not yet come perspective, it seems somewhat awkward to explain why an event so remarkable that all of history is numbered as either before or after the incarnation should not be mentioned, especially since Christians, unlike the Jews, believe that Jesus was the incarnation of the Messiah. The acceptance of the Jewish view that the life of Jesus was not remarkable enough to be represented in the march of history is contrary to Christian dogma. So instead, the focus of Bible study is often placed instead on the fourth kingdom. That kingdom is then expanded beyond all resemblance to the other three, existing for millennia, being personified first by Rome, then the Roman Catholic Church, which certain interpretations of Revelation chapter 13 have being sustained by the power of the United States to restore it to the former glory it manifested under Imperial Rome. Much of that type of interpretation is outlined with historical examples, like the St. Bartholomew's massacre of the Huguenots in France offered in evidence, in Ellen White's book, The Great Controversy. At the time of the Reformation, the rhetoric was harsh and inflammatory between Protestants and Catholics, often coming to blows and death to be inflicted by whichever group enjoyed access to the political power of the state at the time. Even today, that same harsh rhetoric bubbles to the surface, but the opposition of the state to religious persecution has kept such hostilities from boiling over into open warfare. That delicately contrived balance, which is at times threatened by state actors supporting a religious agenda, has many uneasy about the possible threat to the secular state posed by Islam. But if we admit concern about this, then we are tacitly endorsing the idea that we believe that we are living in a time predicted by Daniel that does not even mention Islam as a concerning threat to the kingdom of God. In all the horns and toes and other symbols, how could something like that be overlooked? As we will discover in later chapters, the books of Daniel and Revelation are key foundational texts for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Much of Adventism's historic antipathy to Catholicism derives from a focused anti-Roman Catholic perspective, derived from their peculiar interpretation of the Aramaic portion of Daniel, coupled with Revelation chapters 12 and 13. The genesis of Seventh-day Adventism is tied more directly to a pair of timelines presented in the next two chapters, as passed through the interpretive lens of William Miller in the early 19th century. It arose out of date setting tied to the parousia and continues to sustain itself with a claim of inerrancy regarding William Miller's final date, set in October 1844. This inerrancy is insisted upon in spite of the cryptic nature of the later chapters of Daniel, especially chapter 11. Finally, we should spend some time regarding the beasts and the parallels between chapters 2 and 7. The two-winged lion is a parallel symbol to the golden head of the image in chapter 2. The bear is a parallel to the chest and arms of silver on the image. The leopard with four wings and four heads is parallel to the belly and thighs of brass. The beast with iron teeth is a parallel to the legs of iron of the statue. Sequentially, these are commonly seen to represent Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. The ten horns are parallel to the ten toes, which have been often identified with ten kingdoms in Europe: the Anglo-Saxons, the Franks, the Alemanni, the Lombards, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Suevi, the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, and the Heruli. However, these identifications are specious and do not take into account other major peoples active in the region or the shifting geographic and political relationships between them. For instance, both the Lombards and the Alemanni were subgroups of the larger Suevi peoples, also called Suevi. So why would the Alemanni and the Lombards each be equally symbolized as toes or horns equal to the Suevi? This interpretation is made to fit the idea of the little horn defeating three of the horns by claiming that the little horn destroyed the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, and the Heruli. In fact, it was not the little horn, but another horn, the Lombards, who destroyed the Heruli. While the Ostrogoths and the Vandals were indeed destroyed, it was by Byzantium and not Rome. Italy was an Ostrogothic kingdom under Theodoric, and it took several battles over a number of years with Theodoric and successor kings to drive them from the Italian peninsula. Presumably, they returned to the Nordic lands from which they came. What is important about this distinction is that Byzantium is a foundation for the Eastern Orthodox Church, not the Roman Catholic Church. So it should perhaps represent Eastern Orthodox power rather than Roman Catholic. After all, it was Justinian I of Byzantium who, at the urging of the Eastern Orthodox Church, outlawed paganism and Arianism, and then waged war on behalf of the church against the Ostrogoths and Vandals, who were both Arian Christians. The Roman Catholic Church actually supported Theodoric and the Ostrogoths at the time. The idea of Roman Catholic dominance may be a forced application made to fill the need to fit a peculiar apocalyptic agenda, or it may simply be a reflection of the extreme anti-Catholic sentiment that existed in the United States at the time Adventism came into being. There is also a possible motivation for wanting to nail down in fine detail prophecy, although inaccurately. At this point, some may question whom I think the ten horns or ten toes represent, but I would ask in response about why it is necessary to know all the answers. The idea of God in a box and prophecy in a box are closely related. They imply that one can have enough understanding of either to make one's own interpretation into a fundamental test of faith. When that happens, we begin to divide the world into those who do not see things as we do and therefore are hell-bound, and those who perfectly mirror the image that we have constructed. Since we are all flawed to some degree in our abilities, including me, the danger of creating such images and expecting people to honor them is not far removed from the image Nebuchadnezzar raised on the plain of Dura before we condemn anyone to the fiery furnaces of hell. We might want to humbly acknowledge that, like Nebuchadnezzar, we don't have all the answers. Thank you for listening to this commentary. You can read more at Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com.